Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Thanks for listening, everybody. My next guests are the editors of a new volume focused on solving that eternal question of how to give college students more bang for your bucks, especially given just how many bucks it takes to get an education. I'm joined now by Andrew P. Kelly. He's a resident scholar and director of the Center on Higher Education Reform at the American Enterprise Institute think tank, and Kevin Carey, who is director of the Education Policy Program at the New America Foundation. Their new book is titled Stretching the Higher Education Dollar: How Innovation Can Improve Access, Equity, and Affordability. Andrew and Kevin, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having us.
So that introduction may have raised eyebrows among listeners familiar with the think tank world, because your two employers aren't exactly known for lining up ideologically. So maybe you could start with, what's the common ground between you two when it comes to reforming higher education? Kevin from New America Foundation, you want to start?
Sure. Well, I don't think college affordability is an ideological issue. I think it doesn't matter whether you're left or right, Democrat or Republican. Everybody wants to make sure that their kids have a head start in the economy, and anyone who's got a child in high school who he or she wants to send in college is probably very concerned about how they're going to pay those bills.
And Andrew from AEI?
So this project was born when Kevin and I were actually visiting an innovative community college out in Arizona, and it happened to be right around the time that Governor Rick Perry in Texas made the challenge to his colleges and universities to create a $10,000 bachelor's degree. And Kevin and I got to talking in our visit to Arizona and said, how could you actually do that, and how would it be possible? And we found that we had a lot of common ground, and so we decided to go forward with this project and actually carry the thought experiment out.
Well, let's go right to that example, which is one of the innovative ways to make college a better deal in your book. Texas Governor Rick Perry requested in 2011 that the state's public universities create bachelor's degree programs that cost in total no more than $10,000. Do I have that right?
That's yes, correct. That's right.
And they did?
Kevin?
Actually the number of institutions have responded very positively. When it came out, some people said, Rick Perry's being crazy. But in fact, no one could ever do that. But, we all think of colleges as being things that cost $50,000 a year, but that's really only a small number of private colleges and universities. In fact, there are a lot of public institutions that don't charge that much and aren't as expensive in terms of what it costs them to provide an education to students. And what we found is that the institutions responding to Governor Perry's call have condensed some of the broad-ranging curricula that students offer, and what they've done is they've made innovative uses of online technology, which, if done correctly, can actually offer a high-quality education at a lower price.
And what does that $10,000 figure represent? Is that tuition, room, and board for 1 year? Is that 4 years? What is that $10,000?
That's a very important point. And
yeah.
And what happened was what Governor Perry was referring to was the price to the consumers and not necessarily the cost all in of providing the degree. And it's an important distinction because you can bring down the price of college for students with other government subsidies and scholarships, also by having them go to take some of their instruction at a lower cost institution like a community college. So Governor Perry's challenge is very rhetorically important. I think it's got us focused on how do we make this this product much more affordable. I think what we've seen in Texas is some innovative ideas around how to give students access to low-cost credits. I don't know that we've seen the full extent of the innovation that that the governor had in mind, but credit to Texas for taking the challenge on.
And Kevin, when you talked about limited curriculum, I saw some people out there cringe with my mind's eye, thinking, oh, is that what education is going to become to make it more affordable? It's going to become vocational training, and there isn't going to be a broad education of the mind?
Well, I think that we ought to be, first of all, realistic and cognizant of what students are actually going to college for. Far and away, the most popular major in the United States is business. And by far, there are more people majoring in business as undergraduates than anything else. The other big categories are things like accounting, teaching, nursing. I mean, these are programs that prepare students for jobs, because I'll tell you what, you have to get a job in order to be able to pay back the loans that most students are paying to go to college in the first place. So when I say limiting the curriculum, I don't mean denaturing the curriculum. I don't mean refusing to expose students to the wide array of intellectual offerings that a college can potentially give them. What it does mean is making some choices about what students are going to study as they, you know, move through their degree, and giving them the option, if they want to move on a very directed path toward a degree that will prepare them for the kind of career they want.
Listeners, anything you would suggest as an innovative way to make college more affordable, or anything you want to ask our guests, co-authors of the new book, Stretching the Higher Education Dollar, How Innovation Can Improve Access, Equity, and Affordability. Call in at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Does a capitalist approach ever work with colleges? That is to say, can you treat colleges like other money-generating businesses? I see you have a chapter that refers to Bain Capital consulting universities.
I mean, look, when we talk about colleges and universities, there's often, especially nonprofit and publics in particular, there's a sense that they don't operate under the same incentives, and that's true to an extent. But it's also true that institutions of higher education are reliant on revenue, right? Whether that revenue comes from the state or from student tuition dollars, and that leads them to behave in ways that will help them to raise more revenue. And so, one of the points that we make early in the book, that one of our authors makes early in the book, is that this nonprofit incentive is not all that different in terms of the effect it has on costs. Colleges tend to there's something called the Bowen hypothesis, and that is colleges raise all the money they can and they spend all the money they raise in an effort to raise educational quality. So as a result, what we see is rising costs, and it's sort of coming from a place that they want to raise quality, but it also tends to raise costs tremendously. So I think we sort of oversimplify when we say that colleges are not acting like private sector firms. There are some things that are consistent across the board.
And so,
how we just found out recently that New York University was, in order to recruit people, was giving out low-cost loans for vacation houses.
Right.
That looks a lot to me like an organization operating in a free market for labor and trying to pay what it thinks that labor is worth.
So
we shouldn't just, you know, pretend that colleges are in some special realm where the laws of supply and demand don't apply.
So then give me an example of how you can apply market principles to not-for-profit universities to make them more efficient.
Well, what I think we need to do is students and parents have more choices now for going to college than they've ever had before. And that can be really confusing. As a parent, I think I would have a lot of anxiety about making sure that I made the right decision for my child, one, because their degree is important, and two, because there's a lot of money at stake. But you can only really make good choices if you have information about your options. And really, in a lot of ways, students and parents are operating in a real void of good information. You can find out if the dorms are nice and what the record of the football team was last year. What you can't really find out is, am I going to learn anything, and am I going to get a good job when I finish? And those are really the things that students need to know. So that's a kind of a market. You know, it's people making choices among different providers of a service. But we think that we can help them make better choices.
And how would you make that kind of information more transparent?
I mean, this gets to the heart of what President Obama was talking about a couple weeks ago at the end of August, which is thinking about shifting our emphasis in higher education in measuring quality from inputs, the quality of the students you get and how much money you spend to serve them, to outputs and value and how much bang or how much education are you getting for the dollars you invest. And so there are two separate questions. One is, what kind of data do we need to measure value? And the other question is then, how do we make those data public in a way that consumers can use? On the former question, one of the problems we have now is that we'd like, reformers would like to link up some labor market outcomes. So how well do you do with your degree from X university with your post-secondary experience so that you can then tell consumers what they can expect? Right now, there's a federal ban on collecting such data at the federal level, which limits us because we can't follow students that leave this, you know, we can't follow students across state borders and so on. So that's the first problem to solve, frankly, before we figure out how to make it more accessible.
Andrew Kelly and Kevin Carey, authors of Stretching the Higher Education Dollar, How Innovation Can Improve Access, Equity, and Affordability. Our lines are jammed with people wanting to participate in this conversation. So Myra in Fanwood, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yeah, I think there's even another issue that sort of plays into that. I mean, ProPublica just recently did a study looking at public colleges and how they're funding lower-income students, and obviously public colleges are the place where the vast majority of students get educated, and they're giving less and less money to lower-income students. So there's other critical issues that sort of play into this. I mean, there is a serious, serious problem in educating people who need help the most. So, you know, how do we address that as well?
It's a great question.
The ProPublica study is fantastic. I would urge everyone to take a look at it. And what it really shows is how state governments routinely discriminate against middle-class and lower-income students by giving less money per student to the colleges that tend to educate students from those backgrounds. So for every, you know, for every $10 that goes to the flagship public university, which tends to be disproportionately full of rich students, maybe only 50 cents goes to the local community college or open access city college. And that's not fair. It's not right. And that's something that constituents need to bring to their representatives to demand, you know, frankly, justice when it comes to funding higher education.
So that would also require an amount of political pressure, right? Because if states have been cutting funding from their state university systems, it's because they feel less pressure to keep it higher than they feel to do other things, spend it on other things or cut taxes or whatever.
Yeah, generally, when states have felt a budget pinch, a budget crunch, which they certainly have over the past 5 to 6 years, they've generally cut higher education funding because colleges are thought to have another revenue source, namely the tuition dollars of the students they attract. So we've seen this across the board, and this is certainly responsible for the tuition increases that we've seen in the near term at public colleges and universities. And that's an important fact. I would also suggest, though, that colleges and universities have choices when they greet these budget crises. They can either choose to jack tuition, or they can think about ways to re-engineer their model to contain costs and even lower the cost of delivery in order to maintain low tuition prices. We've seen that in some places, but we haven't seen as much of it as I think the country needs.
Sarah in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I have a comment couched in a question. I was wondering, because it was mentioned that more and more students are choosing business and accounting as their majors in college, and as someone who had the good fortune, I just graduated 3 years ago, as someone who had the good fortune of being able to study the humanities in college, I wondered if that trend was really actually a result of the cost of college. And I mean, I think that there's really great value to young people being able to have 4 years of an undergraduate education that involves self-discovery. And, you know, I just think there's value to a humanities education as well. And I wonder if this sort of pragmatic shift is a result of the prohibitive cost of college.
It's a great question. Cause and effect.
Right.
Go ahead.
I think you're absolutely right about that. And, you know, people get uncomfortable when we talk about making college less expensive, as if we're, you know, inappropriately applying business principles to, you know, a non-business. But the fact of the matter is, if colleges operate inefficiently and they pass that cost on to students, it forces exactly the kind of choice you're talking about. It means that basically only the rich will be able to study the humanities, and everyone else will have to get by with, you know, a more vocational approach. I want the humanities to be available to everyone. But we're going to need colleges and universities to find models of education that are not so expensive that they exclude, you know, all but the wealthy students.
One recurring theme in your book is the way that technology and online open source classes are changing higher learning. We've talked before on the show about MOOCs, or massive open online courses, which often provide high caliber coursework and lectures to pretty much anyone for free. Does this option threaten the monetary value of traditional classroom learning?
Look, I think what we're seeing actually is a shift, a fundamental shift in the way we think about higher education. For almost 1,000 years, higher education has been organized around a notion of scarcity. Right? We assemble smart people and books and in later years lab equipment in one place, and then we ration access to that place. Right? Often on the basis of how smart you are and how good your high school was. Right now, with the sort of internet revolution and the MOOC movement and other things that predate it, OpenCourseWare, the components of a college degree in terms of content, instruction, and assessment are more plentiful and more abundant than they ever have been before. It changes our logic about how we think about higher education and pricing of higher education. Once you get past that bundled model, which is very expensive to build and offer, it opens up a whole range of possibilities to really drive down the cost of coursework and then adding that coursework together into a degree or a credential that has labor market value.
But then what's your take on how much labor market value these MOOCs would actually provide people and how much the traditional notion of an accredited college is under attack or should be under attack?
Well, I think that's all. We're figuring that out right now. MOOCs are brand new. It is certainly at the scale we're looking at. The MOOC providers are starting with the courses. The next step is to figure out what it means to have passed one of those courses. Earlier this year, I took an entire MOOC from MIT, got a really good grade on it, did all the same work, literally exactly the same work that freshmen at MIT were doing at the same time, mm-hmm. the same exams, the same professor, everything. They all got 3 credits from MIT. I have a piece of paper from MITx saying that I did the same thing. In a rational world, and I think the world tends to become rational in the long run, that piece of paper will mean what it means, which is that I learned some things. Figuring out how to integrate that information into formal credentials that actually work in the labor market is a significant logistical challenge, but it's really only a logistical challenge, not a conceptual one.
And if I could just add, one of the things that employers are dealing with these days is when young people come to them with lots and lots of debt, right, in order for that person to take that job, they have a high reservation wage, what an economist would call a high reservation wage. They have to pay off their student debt. Employers are going to increasingly seek opportunities to hire people with the same basic set of skills and proof of those skills at a lower wage. And it's not to say that person is going to be a low-wage worker. They're just going to be paid slightly less because they don't have the student loan payments that somebody that went to a traditional institution has. And so businesses are going to figure this out eventually. And I think they're increasingly starting to figure it out. And it's an opportunity for them to hire good people at a lower cost.
George in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Andrew Kelly and Kevin Carey, authors of Stretching the Higher Education Dollar. Hi, George.
Good afternoon. I had 2 points. We've kind of moved a little bit off the subject, but I think part of the higher cost of the traditional education today is the growth in the number of employees who do not actually talk to students, i.e. teach them. Management layers, you would say, in the commercial world. The other point is that the availability of funds for federal government loans to students has not caused universities to be concerned about the prices they charge. There's no cost downward pressure when the funds availability is large.
Do you agree with that last statement, either of you?
Here's what I would say. I think, first of all, the point about administrative costs is exactly right. There are very clear statistics that show that increased spending in colleges and universities actually isn't going into the classroom. The professors aren't getting the money. The students aren't getting the money. What we see is a growing administrative class in a lot of colleges and universities and a lot of spending on marketing and amenities and things other than education. That's a problem. Second, it is definitely the case that federal grant funds have been distributed in a way that was indifferent to rising costs and prices. Andrew alluded a little while ago to President Obama's recent higher education speech from a couple of weeks ago. In that speech, the president explicitly said what he wants to do is identify colleges that do a really good job of helping students graduate at a relatively low cost and provide extra money to students attending colleges like that. So I think that's a signal that federal policymakers are starting to think about a different approach.
But his second point is one that I often hear from conservatives on the Sunday talk shows when this issue comes up, and that is that the availability of low-cost student loans and federal aid just pushes up the cost of college, because all they're really looking at is how much the consumer is willing to pay. And if you can afford $10,000 a year and the government gives you another $5,000 a year, well, you can still afford $10,000 a year, so they're going to charge $15,000. Does that math work for you?
So I think this is an important point, and it's one that you're right. We hear a lot about. So I think there's a couple important distinctions to make. Number one, there's been an effort by researchers to prove a sort of causal effect here, that every time the federal government raises its loan limits, that tuition then increases a requisite amount. That's been difficult to document in a causal way by economists. But from my perspective, the causal link is not as important as to talk about what it does to the incentives for colleges when they're faced with a budget crunch about what to do about their tuition rates. Right now, because, as you said, the government can actually help people pay more than they have, that tends to change the incentives that a college might have in the absence of that aid. The second point is just it's important to distinguish here between grant money from the federal government and loan money, and in particular between particular loan programs. Loan programs for undergraduates have stricter limits than, say, loan programs for parents and for graduate students. That's where we see a lot of the cost inflation problems, and that's where we need some fundamental reform. And Kevin and his colleagues at New America Foundation have done some great work on that.
By the way, Jeremy writes in, I am currently taking a calculus MOOC, and it's better than any math class I took at my top 10 school. There are some classes where I think MOOCs are better and some that probably they are worse in. I can't imagine discussion sections or labs being better with the Internet, but MOOCulous at Ohio State is so much fun, so instructive, and so clear. Let's get one more caller in here before we run out of time, and it goes back to that Texas example, I think, of Governor Perry trying to establish some state schools that only charge $10,000 for a college education. Catherine, hi.
Hi, yes, exactly. It actually ties into the last couple of comments, but I wanted to refute one of the premises of the authors, that $10,000 education, it can have a very political dynamic. We have a whole underclass preyed on by the for-profit universities, and many of them don't get degrees or degrees that are useless. But the disproportionate funding that you were just talking about, it could be, you know, it can have the authors look into whether or not that is a part of this $10,000 degree. Are we creating another useless degree for an underclass that we don't care about?
That's a great question. And we're going to end on this, so give us your best response for Catherine in Massapequa.
Well, I would just start with by saying, and I'll defer to you, Kevin, for the last word. But I would just say that the cost problem here, the affordability problem, is not a for-profit question. It's not a nonprofit question. It's not a public university question. It is a question that runs across the board, and we need to get a handle on how to rein in these costs in order to better serve those particular folks, the underserved, the low-income families, who more than ever need some kind of post-secondary education, not necessarily a bachelor's degree, but need some kind of post-secondary education to have a hope of reaching the middle class. This is about more than tax status. This is about the fundamental economics of higher ed, and we've got to change them.
Yeah, I would just say, I mean, these are, in Texas, public universities that have been charged with creating this degree. You're absolutely right. $10,000 for a worthless degree is a bad deal. But personally, I have more confidence in nonprofit public institutions that are accountable to the voters to keep a hard eye on quality than other institutions.
Kevin Carey, Director of the Education Program at the New America Foundation, and Andrew Kelly, Resident Scholar and Director of the Center on Higher Education Reform at the American Enterprise Institute. Together they have a new book, Stretching the Higher Education Dollar, How Innovation Can Improve Access, Equity, and Affordability. This is such an important conversation for the future of our country. Thank you very much for having it with us.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, exploring the New York City underground. Literally. Stay tuned.